on KHOY Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-host, Jim Werbel. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Ursula, and hello to you, the listener.
Jim, you were gone for a while, out of the country, I think. Is that right?
That's right. I was in Portugal and then in England and Wales, where I broke my wrist.
Oh. Did the Welsh do that to you?
No, I just did it to myself, falling and tripping.
So they have socialized medicine in Wales, too?
Yeah, and the operation was very good, and everything was real well. I had no problem with socialized medicine in England.
Okay, well, thank you for coming back to us, alive and well, and if somewhat injured. And it's really great to have you back on the Local Talk team and to have you co-hosting again.
Thank you.
In the morning. And you looked into the weather for this week?
Yes, I did. As people can see, there's a cold front with thunderstorms on today, Monday, July the 6th. Then we'll have highs in the mid to low 70s through Thursday, when there's another 40% chance of thunderstorms, clearing on Friday with highs apparently in the mid-80s.
In the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
So summer's here.
Yep.
And it's very, very humid, obviously.
Right, today. But then it'll cool off. It should be pretty, for those who like cool weather, it'll be very cool for the next several days. But no, probably not good swimming weather.
Okay, and then you're also bringing us a business news story today.
That's correct. As you know, I like topics related to business news. And a current topic is an ordinance that was recently passed by the Ames City Council dealing with merchants that buy or sell secondhand goods and how it affects businesses and citizens in recovery of stolen goods. I looked into this last week and was able to record interviews with Gary Youngberg of Ames Silversmithing, Judy Gilger of Gilger Designs, as well as Commander Huff of the Ames Police Force, addressing the different perspectives of this ordinance. Here's what I learned. I'd like to welcome Jeff Huff to the show. He is the commander of the Ames Police Force, and he'll be talking to us today about the secondhand goods ordinance, which was recently passed by the Ames City Council. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you. Appreciate you inviting me.
I'd like to ask you that this new ordinance requires some new reporting requirements. Would you care to tell us what exactly are the new reporting requirements of this ordinance?
Yeah, the ordinance itself is not exactly new. There had been an ordinance in place that covered mostly pawn shops, pawn brokers. And what we found over the last, few years, especially the last 10 years or so, is that there are other businesses that are engaged in identical activities as pawnbrokers that weren't covered by the ordinance. So there's a lot of businesses in Ames now that buy secondhand goods. And so what we tried to do with the ordinance is to capture and change the reporting requirement so that similar transactions are reported similarly. So if you're buying secondhand goods the same way that a pawn shop is, you should probably have to report them just like a pawn shop does. And the pawn shop has been reporting them for years.
So what you're asking firms, businesses, and Ames to do is to do exactly what pawn shops have been doing if they are purchasing secondhand goods and then reselling them in some form.
Correct. And there's a lot of businesses that people probably wouldn't think about that are buying stuff back. So there's a place called Gamers, and they buy used games. And that would be something that the pawn shop would also do and would have had to report. But if you did it at Gamers, you wouldn't have to. Walmart does secondhand goods. So they bring in telephones sometimes, and they'll either give you store credit or some other kind of credit to get a new phone or to get other merchandise. And so, seeing that, it didn't seem really fair to us that we were, selecting one type of business to have to report transactions. Instead, we're looking at the transactions themselves. So if the transactions meet the requirements, they have to be reported, not what kind of business you happen to run.
So what exactly does Gamers have to do when someone sells back a game to Gamers? What exactly is going to be different for that business, or what are pawn shops currently doing?
Right. One of the things that we decided early on was we needed to make it easy for people to report to us, because we know that it's a little bit of an imposition, especially for businesses that are not used to having to report things. So a part of this has been identifying an online reporting, which is Leeds Online is the name of the company that we went with. We pay for that. The police department, the city pays for it, and it's free to the end users. And all they have to do is set up an account, which literally takes 5 minutes. And then if one of the transactions that you happen to be making meets the requirements, then you have to input a little bit of information. So the item that you're taking in, if it's got a serial number, we'd like to have that, obviously, the name of the person that's selling it. And in some cases, we ask that they take a picture of the item. And what that does for us is we get all those reports in, and if we have something that's missing, we can look for it pretty easily using our software, the Leads Online. We can look for it, and it saves our detectives especially from having to go to all these different businesses to look for stolen property. Instead, we can go to one place and look for it, and it's generally not we don't have an everyday kind of thing where we're bringing in stolen property, but it's at least weekly that we're finding things that have been stolen. In fact, in this last week, we found two big screen TVs that were stolen that we found because of Leads Online.
So you're trying to identify people that are fencing stolen goods more easily, more readily, and protecting individuals so they can recover their stolen goods more easily.
Right. The whole idea of this ordinance is to protect our victims. Every time that we can identify something that's been stolen and get that back to the rightful owner is a win for us, and it's a win for our victims, and it's a win for our citizens. And I think there's another part of this is the more businesses we have that are reporting, that word's going to get out too. And maybe that means that as the store owner, you're not going to be the victim either, because someone's not going to bring something to you if it's stolen because they know it'll probably be identified. And unfortunately, in a lot of these cases, the businesses become victims, because if we locate something that's been stolen, we take possession of it back and we return it to the owner, and sometimes the store is out. Now, we try and get restitution. If we can file charges against somebody, then a part of that process is trying to get the business restitution so that they, you know, are made whole again as well, because they're also a victim in this whole thing.
Do other cities have similar ordinance? If so, which ones?
Yeah, we looked at Des Moines. We looked at Davenport. I know there's a few others in there. I don't know them all off the top of my head. But when we got into this, you know, we talked to some of those cities, and they said exactly the same thing. There's a lot of businesses now that are doing the secondhand goods kind of dealing that they didn't do in the past. And this was a good way to capture those. Some of them are more restrictive. Obviously, some of them are less restrictive than ours is. We're kind of somewhere in the middle as far as the reporting requirements. You know, we definitely want to be fair in the ordinance. But again, at the end of the day, this is all about trying to get stolen property back to our victims.
Are some businesses more likely than others to deal with stolen goods, do you think?
You know, I thought about that question, and that's kind of a tough one. I think pawn shops get a bad rap sometimes, and certainly people do go to pawn shops to sell stolen items because we recover them there. So it obviously happens. But there's a lot that's going on that we don't know about, because a lot of these stores that we're talking about have not had any reporting requirements. So it's one of those, we don't know what we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And as time goes on, I think we'll find out whether some of these businesses have inadvertently been taking stolen property in as well. And hopefully that'll give us an in on those and, again, be able to get some of that stuff back, get it back to the victim.
Some of the merchants in town feel that the reporting requirements are a bit onerous, especially that they have to report every day anything that they purchase secondhand. And so there's an immediacy to it that they feel awkward about. Do you think this will discourage some merchants from purchasing secondhand goods?
It's hard to say. I know that there's a few businesses that aren't very happy with it. As far as the time it takes to enter, it really doesn't take very long. I had Leads Online set up a fake account for the police department as though we were a business so that I could say for sure how long it took to do these things. And so, again, it took me about 5 minutes to set up the fake Ames business that was a secondhand goods store. And I entered a couple of items through the system with no training from Leads Online. And it took me about 2.5 minutes per item. And then we've talked to some of the businesses so far that we don't necessarily need an entry for each individual item. But if they have someone that comes in with a group of items that are similar, you could probably do one transaction, and if we don't happen to be missing anything like that, you know, it's not going to be a big deal. If we are, then we know where to start looking, and we can go to the store. And we're still – it's not going to alleviate all of the time that it takes us to go to a store to look at stuff, because if we suspect something's been stolen, we're still going to need to go and look and try and identify it. So whether or not some of the businesses may choose not to take secondhand goods, I can't answer. I just know that the time it takes to enter the items is pretty small.
So you view this as a much deeper sweep to be more effective at recovering stolen goods?
Yeah, I do. And I think what it does, at least from our perspective, is it levels the playing field. Again, we're looking at the transactions versus the business type. Mm-hmm. I've always thought it's not really fair that the pawnbrokers and pawn dealers have to report when exactly the same transaction is happening over at a different store, but they don't have to.
So there's an issue of fairness for people doing identical things, and one business is covered and another is not covered by the law.
Correct. And we understand this is a slight imposition on some of these businesses that haven't had to report before. Pawn shops, they're set up to do this anyway. They've been doing it for a long time. It's easy for them. They actually have computer systems that they just input information in very quickly, and it transitions over to leads online, and it gets into the system very simply. Other people, it's going to take them a little bit more time to get up and running. But having been in the position that I have entered information into it, so I know what it looks like, I know that it doesn't take that long. And that's what we're asking. We're asking them to take a little bit of time to help protect our victims.
Some people object to this ordinance as a violation of privacy and search, inappropriate search and seizure. Do you have any responses to that comment?
Not really. I'm not an attorney. We've had our attorneys look at it, and being the city attorney and the county attorney, who've said there's no Fourth Amendment implications. And I know that a private attorney working for one of the businesses that is opposed to it has also looked at it and said there isn't any Fourth Amendment issues with it. So that's about as far as I can comment, since I'm not an attorney.
Jeff, do you have any other comments that you'd like to share with the audience regarding the topic of secondhand, purchasing secondhand items?
I just go back to reiterate, this is about handling similar transactions similarly. That's where we're at with the ordinance, is we want to make sure that if business A is reporting, business B is reporting too, if it's the same kind of transaction. And it, for us, again, it goes back to our victims. People, you know, when you're the victim of a burglary or a theft, you feel awful and you feel violated. And every time we can get something back to someone, it's a good feeling for them, and it sort of makes them whole again. And that's the reason we have, we brought these changes to the ordinance, to just try and broaden that net a little bit, get some more stolen property back, and maybe close some of the loopholes, and maybe we'll see fewer burglaries and thefts. Maybe not, but at least it gives us a better chance to get it back to the victim.
I'm just going to make one other comment, because I know from personal experiences, I know somebody who deals a lot with these stolen goods, and it's really a drug problem.
Yeah.
Inevitably, it's a drug problem.
A lot of times that's where the profit comes back to.
90% of it is to support a drug habit of some type.
That happens quite a bit, for sure. You know, it's you get into that lifestyle, and your opportunities are somewhat limited. And so a lot of times that's where you find your profit is in stealing from other people. And a lot of times it's people that can't afford to be victims, which is really sad.
Yeah. And they can't hold down jobs because they're too busy with their drug addictions or alcohol.
It is a full-time job to have a drug addiction, and it's sad. And, you know, and the other thing, the state is cutting back services all the time for both mental health and substance abuse. And so there's fewer opportunities to help people out there. And unfortunately, it falls back on, you know, police departments a lot of time, which is really sad, because while we do a reasonable job with it, that's not our job technically. And we're not as equipped as other services are. So hopefully they quit cutting back on those services, and that may help this problem too. You know, it is, everything is connected, obviously. Thefts and drug addiction, definitely there's a clear connection in those.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jeff.
You bet.
We just heard from Commander Huff about the need for the secondhand goods ordinance. Next, let's listen to the merchant response to this ordinance.
I'd like to welcome Gary Youngberg, who's the co-owner of Ames Silversmithing, and Judy Gilger, who is the co-owner of Gilger Designs, who are going to talk to us today about the secondhand ordinance that was recently passed by the Ames City Council. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi.
Do both of you sometimes buy secondhand goods at your retail operations?
We do occasionally. Most of the product that would fall into the category would be scrap gold or scrap silver that we would buy for the metal value. We do occasionally have customers that will sell precious metal bullion products like gold coins or platinum coins or silver bars, which also fall under the ordinance.
That would be true for us also. It's usually somebody who has inherited a piece that just really doesn't have any reason to keep it. The style isn't something that they like, so they will sell it, and they will use it for some, you know, the money that they get for something else.
So it sounds like neither of you do a lot of secondhand goods.
It's not a major portion of our business, but it's certainly a portion of the business that we find viable for our customers and for ourselves as well.
It is a service. I mean, because people have these items and there really isn't a good secondary market for them. So at least they would get the value of the gold or the silver. So it is a service that we provide.
Let's say you purchase some bullion or buy some jewelry from someone's estate. What do you have to do now to comply with the new ordinance?
Well, we have to take their name, their address, phone number, take a digital photo of it, driver's license number, the state of issue of that driver's license or a state identification card of some sort, and ultimately it will get logged into a database called Leads Online that is accessible by law enforcement personnel.
So there's some data entry that you have to do, a picture that needs to be taken, and then you have to submit it to Leads Online, which the police department has total access to.
That's true, and it has to be done within 24 hours of purchasing. So that requires us to have time to do that on a daily basis.
Now, what is new about this? You certainly, when you under the previous system, with the Leads Online, but is there really that much that's different? Because you'd have to give the person a receipt for the purchase, et cetera. So what's different?
Well, first of all, it includes jewelry stores and the coin shop across the street, where previously it was only the pawn shops, for the most part, that were required. Police felt it was important to have a level playing field in that regard, and that's why they worked with city staff to rewrite the ordinance to include us.
It was, you know, now it's mandatory. Before, we would hold on to items, so if somebody came in and we felt that they had stolen something or had something lost or stolen from their home, they would be able to recover it in the stores. Before, did we always keep records of things? If there are people that we know that want to use that gold to have something else made, we didn't keep records of that because we were taking that gold, sending it to the refiner, and then reusing it again.
The problem that we're having with it is twofold. Of course, as Judy mentioned, the amount of time that's involved for the merchants in order to log this in. From my perspective, the most important is the Fourth Amendment violation of unreasonable search and seizure, and that's what we believe is the umbrella over the whole thing.
As you said, the pawn shops were previously doing this before, and you were not doing it before. Is there any reason why you should not be treated similarly as the pawn shops?
I'll tackle it from my perspective first. You know, the Fourth Amendment is to me, as I mentioned, the umbrella over the whole thing. I don't believe that the pawn shops should be required to have this data taken as well, because ultimately you're infringing on people's privacy rights, and that is expressly prohibited under the Fourth Amendment. I want to be clear that none of us are adversarial with the police. We all cooperate with the police, and we have for many years. I can think of many occasions where we have cooperated with the police in apprehending people that have stolen product, and we'll continue to do so. But it's the forcing of this information into this database, which again is clearly unconstitutional. It's on a smaller scale, but if you recall, the NSA's collection of metadata was ruled unconstitutional by the Second Court of Appeals. And this is exactly what's happening, but on a much smaller scale. You cannot cast a broad net looking for something. You have to have specificity, and there is no specificity in this ordinance.
So what are your objections as a private citizen?
As a private citizen and a business owner, I have a problem with a police officer walking into our store because of knowledge that they have obtained about it, the description of an item that has been stolen or possibly been stolen. So they can walk in our stores and they can say, this one in the case over here I think I read a report. It looks like something that I read that is stolen. I'm going to apprehend it. I'm going to take it. I don't know when I'm going to bring it back. They have the right to do that. They also have the right to look through our entire store if they have any inkling that we may have stolen items, or and they don't have to know exactly. They can believe that it is that item. And I have a real problem with that because so many things are mass-produced. And how is it that they're going to know exactly that that item in our store? We don't sell secondhand things in our store. So it's just too sketchy. It doesn't give you a clear reading. They can just come in and take it.
Would you care to read the sentence in the ordinance that you're referring to?
I would. Every dealer should admit any police officer to its premises during its regular business hours to examine articles purchased or received, and to search for and to take into possession any article known by that officer to have been reported missing or known or believed, that's the one that really gets me, believed by the officer to have been stolen.
And that goes again to the Fourth Amendment issue that I keep bringing up. And if you'll allow me just to read this very quickly, the Fourth Amendment basically provides that the people shall not be subject to unreasonable searches and seizures. It then goes on to define what a search is. And under the Fourth Amendment, a search occurs when a government employee or agent of the government violates an individual's reasonable expectation of privacy. It then goes on to say that the reasonableness standard is construed upon the totality of the circumstances on a case-by-case basis. These are all very clearly delineated in the past, and the Supreme Court, in fact, in Chandler versus Miller, states that to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, a search ordinarily must be based on individualized suspicion of wrongdoing. You can't have a general suspicion that something might be wrong and search a premise. It is unconstitutional.
Would you be willing to take this ordinance to the Supreme Court if you wanted to?
I would take it all the way to the Supreme Court. And in fact, I retained Ben Stone, who's a former director of the ACLU in Des Moines, about a month ago. And I said, Ben, we need to find out if we have some sort of legal standard, if we have some sort of case law that will support our position. And after Ben spent a couple of days, Ben said, unfortunately, no, I can't seem to find anything. And I chuckled and I said, well, Ben, would you like to make case law with me? And then we started talking about what this would actually entail and the amount of time and money. And you're talking tens and tens of thousands of dollars in years and years. And it shouldn't be my job as a citizen or Judy's job as a citizen to prove that this is unconstitutional. One only need read forth and see what is being done and understand that you don't need a lawyer to tell you what's going on here.
To what extent have you worked with law enforcement officials in helping to recover stolen goods?
Well, we had an incident where we had a sting operation. There were some men that were going across the state, and we had mentioned to the police that they had brought in a lot of small coin to pay for something that they purchased. And it just seemed very suspicious. And we had set it up for these gentlemen to come back another time. So in the meantime, before they came back, the police had set up cameras in our store, so they were going to apprehend them, which they were able to do at a later date.
So it is to say that you're concerned about stolen goods, understand that it is a problem.
Absolutely.
It's just that this tool that the police department is using to try to make efforts to recover stolen goods is a violation of Fourth Amendment issues.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'll be the first to tell you that, again, Ames Silversmithing has cooperated for years with the police, and I want nothing more than to get Grandma Jones' ring back when it's stolen. But the issue that remains is how can we violate 99.5% of people's civil liberties in order to retrieve an item or the possible retrieval of one item? I've not yet gotten a great answer to that.
Let's see. Let me summarize your positions, and then if you want to make any final comments, please feel free to make those final comments. So at this time, both of you find the ordinance as it stands. It's a little scary for you, both in terms of violation of freedoms as well as what the police are capable of doing to confiscate merchandise that they believe to be stolen. You believe that this gives them more power than what they should have. Do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
I would just like to invite everybody to come who disagree with this new ordinance to come to Ames Silversmithing, Gilger Designs, Swank's Pumpkin Patch, or Chester's and fill their name in on the line. All we're asking for is your name and your town. You don't need to give us any more information than that.
Well, the other thing that I find important, Jim, is the local paper, the Ames Tribune, has taken a really strong stance and written an op-ed that requests that the ordinance be rescinded because they see multiple problems with it. And I give great kudos to Michael Crum and the Ames Tribune for taking that stand because it's not easy to put yourself out there sometimes. But I think this is a significant enough issue. And Michael agreed after conversing with us. And I was just pleased to see that they would take that stand.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-host, Jim Werbel. And Jim was speaking with local business people, Gary Youngberg of Ames Silversmithing, and Judy Gilger of Judy Gilger Designs, as well as Commander Huff of the Ames City Police. They were addressing different perspectives on the Ames Ordinance dealing with merchants that buy or sell secondhand goods, and how this affects business and citizens and recovery of stolen goods. A very interesting issue. And thank you, Jim, for coming back to us and covering this piece of business news.
Good to be back.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see where you go next.
Yes. Some of our young folks have we have one young lady here who's joined us today from the School of Rock. We have
Aaliyah Gerganis and Al Biela, the founder and teacher and mentor at School of Rock. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having us here. This is great.
Aaliyah, you are going to be performing in the upcoming annual summer performance of the School of Rock. And we're looking forward to hearing what you produce as a musician. And Al, why don't you, for starters, explain this concert that's coming up and just give us a brief synopsis of what the School of Rock is in case somebody doesn't know it.
Great. Well, we've got two concerts coming up at Zeke's next weekend, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. And everyone is sure welcome to come and see what's going on with the Iowa School of Rock. We'll have five bands, including the Iowa School of Jazz Band. They're going to open up the show. And then after that, we are just going to rock. And so we've had 2 weeks of practices together, most of the bands, that's what they're doing. And we start from scratch, basically, and put together a band, get some songs going. They put together a band identity. They're still working on their names and stuff like that. But, hey, in 2 weeks, you got to really cram and get everything done. And we're doing all sorts of activities, kind of like we're doing this morning, figuring out what do you do to let the general public know that you're doing something with your band. And so we put the kids through all those paces.
So who are exactly the people in the School of Rock?
The students?
Mm-hmm.
They are really anybody who wants to participate.
Age, how old?
Age 10 and up. And we have historically had, actually, we've let a couple of 9-year-olds in there. Hey, you know, we're pretty freewheeling that way. And when I say and up, we've had adult bands. We had, 1 year we had, the mom was in one band and her son was in another band, and the skill levels are really mixed. I mean, we're not so concerned with everybody matching on a skill level. What we're going to do is we're going to create a role, a niche for everybody in the band. And it's amazing how the kids rise to the occasion. Somebody who doesn't have a huge skill set figures out how to use what they have to get the job done.
So basically, in the summer, there's a 2-week period where everybody comes together and you put them into different bands.
Yeah.
And then they work out a certain number of songs.
Yep.
And then apparently, from what you're saying, you also give them some training in how to promote yourself and the part of being a musician and an artist that has to do with selling yourself to the public, right?
Absolutely. Everything about, you know, the band creates an identity for itself, and they look at all the things they can do to foster that. Everything from the way they're going to appear on stage to the name of the band.
Mm-hmm. Now, you call it the Iowa School of Rock. Where is the farthest community that people are coming from?
Well, this year everybody's pretty central Iowa, so I'm not sure.
So most people are from Ames?
No. Des Moines, Ankeny, Marshalltown. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean we've had kids come from out of state and do it with their cousin. Like that's uh-huh. their summer vacation, visit their cousin and do Iowa School of Rock.
Nice. So Aaliyah, you are one of these folks that are in the Iowa School of Rock. How many years have you been doing it?
This'll be my fourth year.
And how old are you?
I'll be 13 right after the concert. Uh-huh. So it'll be fun.
So you'll be 13. So you're 12 now, and you'll be 13 in about a week.
Yes.
And so tell me the name. What's the name of the band that you're in?
We don't really have a band name quite yet. We're working on that today at practice. But so far, our nickname is 3 p.m.
3 p.m. And why 3 p.m.?
It's very simple, actually. It's because our band starts practice at 3 p.m.
Oh, that's very... that's an obvious and pretty clear name. So,
Are you familiar with everybody in your band? Have you played music with them before?
I have. One kid goes to my school, and I've been in a band with all the rest of them for 1 or 2 years now.
Yeah.
You're the youngest band in the group, right?
Yes.
We're talking with the Iowa School of Rock about the upcoming summer concert, which is always kind of the culmination.
Yes.
And that's going to be on July 10th and 11th at 7:30 at Zeke's, which is now called Blue Stems, right?
Yeah.
On the western edge of town.
That's right.
Aaliyah, what do you do in the band?
I sing and I am a guitarist.
Tell us a little bit about some of the music that you're going to be performing.
Our music style for our band is basically we do Rolling in the Deep, Take on Me, Straight Cat Strut, and Daylight. So it's more of kind of 80s songs and pop songs.
Did you choose this music?
We get a CD and it's kind of chosen for us, but I think the picks are very well done.
Al, how do you choose the music?
That's kind of evolved over time. And originally, we'd create a short list. The coaches would just sit down and look at what we knew about the students who were coming in, what we know about putting songs together for a band and coming up with something that's credible and effective, and just kind of maximizing what we think they can pull off. And originally, we would give them a short list, and they would vote on the songs, and we'd go with that. And one thing we decided is we wanted the show to really be a pretty broad representation of what's going on in rock and pop music. We decided we would go ahead and just assign songs to the bands. We hit the ground running knowing what songs we're doing. And mm-hmm. when you only have 2 weeks, that makes a huge difference. And mm-hmm. and one of the differences it makes is that typically each band would do 3 songs. Mm-hmm. And if everything went really smoothly, maybe they'd get to do a 4th song. Well, now all the bands are doing 4 songs. Mm-hmm. And some of them might get to do 5 songs because we've just had that extra day of knowing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So it's partly for the overall show, just to say, you know, we're going to have a show. It's going to have some continuity to it, and it's going to cover a certain range of material. And then also just to hit the ground running better.
Aaliyah, you've been doing this now for a while. What is it like being in the School of Rock?
It's a really fun experience because for me, since I'm not in the ongoing band, I get a new band each year, and I think that's really cool to meet new friends and have new music to perform.
Can you give us one example of something you've learned in this, like this summer?
I've learned that you have to cooperate with your band, and you kind of have to just roll with kind of what happens. Because when you only have the 2-week time period, then it's kind of really hard. If there's an issue, you really have to fix it before it kind of turns into something bigger.
Between the people in the band.
So you're mm-hmm. learning some teamwork skills, basically.
Yes.
And artistic collaboration, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Al, you said there was something interesting about Aaliyah's band.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, there's a lot of interesting things. But the thing I was thinking about is that Aaliyah's a strong singer, for mm-hmm. especially for her age. But she's a strong singer. And so what would typically happen is she'd end up in a band where really she was the only lead singer. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And it's always a lot of work to get there's a lot of young people that are interested in singing, but they are pretty shy about it. I mean, day one, we ask who sings in the band, and most of them just kind of look at their shoes. They don't even want to look at you. And you know that most of them would love to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, in Aaliyah's band, we're finding out that we have some really good voices. And so all of a sudden, we've gone from, you know, just the scenario where Aaliyah's the only singer to now we've got two young guys who are sharing the lead vocal duties on a song. And it turns out that there's another really good singer in the band, too. So that part's really amazing and fun.
Aaliyah, why weren't you shy about singing?
Because I think it's just really fun, and I've kind of always been singing, so it's not really something that I'm, like, insecure about, I guess.
But what's it like to perform on stage?
It's that nervous, exciting feeling.
When you're singing, how does it feel?
It's just a way to express myself, especially with the music that I listen to. It's just a different way of saying how I feel.
Who are you connecting with? Do you feel more connected to the audience or to the band members?
The audience and my band, because I feel the band is also an audience if they're listening. And they're also playing mm-hmm. along, and sometimes the audience does that too. They'll start singing along, and it's just really cool to have the people know the songs and sing along and have fun with it.
This is our 13th session.
Mm-hmm.
So not 13 years, because there's been times when we've done up to three shows a year. So, but now there's a couple things going on. Now we have ongoing bands that Aaliyah mentioned. In the fall, there'll be bands that will go for the whole semester, for the whole school year. And some of those bands, of course, they have a little more time to develop.
You're having a band at 8035 this year. Congratulations.
Yeah, and we're very excited about that. That's on Saturday, and they're playing at 4:15 p.m. on what they call the Generation Z stage.
That's 8035 on Saturday?
Yeah.
Generation Z?
Yeah.
And the performance here in Ames is going to be on July 10th and 11th?
Yes.
At Deeks or Blue Stems?
Yeah.
That's going to be the annual exhibition performance for your show.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming in and joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us here.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We have been talking to some performers about the Iowa School of Rock.
After all the jets are in the boxes, and the clowns have all gone to bed, you can hear happiness staggering on down the street. Footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers merrily. A broom is drearily sweeping up the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping. Somewhere a king has no wife. And the wind, it cries very.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and this is Local Talk, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And we just were graced again by a visit from the Iowa School of Rock. But now, this is the first Monday of the month, so we're very happy to have Keith Morgan here. Keith is the Story County Emergency Management Coordinator, and we're very fortunate to have gotten you to agree to come in the first Monday of every month and talk to us, just have a general check-in about safety.
I appreciate the chance to come on down here. And, yeah, we've got a little bit of rain coming our direction.
an emergency alarm went off. And Keith, why don't you tell us what it is?
What we've got right now is a flash flood warning for Story County that was just issued today. There's flooding on the eastern side of the county along Highway 65. We do have reports of upwards of a foot of water across Highway 65. The key is if you see any water across any of the roads around here, and we're going to go check out the rest of the roads, turn around. Don't think that you'll be able to just drive through it. Many times it's very deceptive how deep the water is, and it takes only about 6 inches or so. Halfway up the tires can push a car off the road. And that's where we have had deaths down in Polk County a couple of years ago. So be safe, turn around, and don't try and cross any of the roads that have water across them. We're always watching the Skunk River. As you know, the Skunk River can come up and go down very quickly. It did spike at the beginning of the week when we had all that rain. It went up very quickly, as we would anticipate, and it started coming back down. And most of the Skunk River, we now have the river basin, and we know where that's at. The ground is pretty saturated right now, and there's the Iowa Flood Center that has got some great graphics, and it monitors the river gauges and can show you where the river basin is. So we're always watching all the time where the rain's falling, what's happening with the river gauges, watching them go up and down, working with the communities along the way to try and give them some sort of a notification and work together with them to see if they're going to be impacted. It's more of how is the ground to the north of us up in Hamilton County and like that right now. So we will be watching these thunderstorms as they go through, see where the rain's dropping, and start monitoring those river gauges that are actually north of us to see where what's happening and where we're going to go.
The Skunk River starts in Hamilton County?
Its basin goes on up into Hamilton County and on over a little bit into Hardin County. We also watch the Squaw Creek, which is Boone County River Basin watershed, and comes on across. So we're looking at those two areas, and when we see the thunderstorms moving through, we're always watching that. The people that are responsible for disaster response in all the different communities
are monitoring it.
Looking at it. We will work closely. Ames is always well ahead of what we're looking at, and we actually have a collaborative where they have good resources to be able to predict what is going to happen. We compare what they predict with what the National Weather Service, what the Flood Center predicts, and mm-hmm. that's also useful information. We all work together. If it's going to be flooding in Ames, then it's going to be flooding down in Cambridge, and you can almost back that on up mm-hmm. to Story City. So we draw upon all those resources and just try and share the information. We call it situational awareness.
Situation awareness. And who in Ames do you work with?
John Dunn over in Waterworks. He is very, very good, works with us, shares the information, and he's got a staff that independently does flood prediction also, so that we have multiple sources to look at.
And what is Waterworks?
That's one of the departments in the Ames City Administration.
That deals with?
That is one subset. They deal with bringing the water up for delivery, and also wastewater.
And then also natural water in the rivers.
And they look at the rivers also. Mm-hmm. They really help us out an awful lot.
Okay. Well, water has definitely kind of been the theme recently in this area.
Yes.
In contrast to California.
Right. Well, we were in a drought just a couple of years ago.
That's right.
As you might remember. So it can go both ways for us.
Did you do anything special for the 4th of July? There was, as you know, a terrorist alert out, possible who knows where, whatever. Did you have to do anything different this year for the 4th of July?
We were aware of it. I get information that comes on into our offices. I was not aware of any specific threats to this area. Sharing that information can be a bit difficult. There may have been even more specific stuff that went to law enforcement that law enforcement may have been acting upon on their own. It comes down to, do they need my resources? Do they need me to do anything? And if there's not, then then they will keep that information to themselves just to protect it.
Why don't you give us an overview of how does Story County work with disaster response work?
Well, it's kind of interesting. First off, communities are our primary responders. They're the ones that try and deal with pretty much all the events that come along. And they try and use the resources that they own and control to take care of that. And as a matter of fact, even before the disaster strikes, they look out and they try and set up what we call mutual aid agreements where they can share resources, which is a great idea because not every community can have all of the resources it's going to take to respond to a disaster. And this is an economical way that they might be able to work together to be able to respond to these disasters.
And is it your job to coordinate the collaboration between the communities?
Oftentimes, yes. Not only just between communities, but between the different disciplines, between fire and law and emergency medical services. One of the things that we're doing is if we should ever have a violent intruder in any facility, we've been working together to try and get it so that they can respond and each will know their role and their position during an event like that that can occur very quickly, can be very different from one situation to the next, but we try and get it so that they can all work together and just click as best as possible in those kind of situations. So we'll try and set up the meetings, have people come in there, have an agenda set up, and then it will take the inputs from all of the different agencies that are in there and try and put it down on paper so that they have something that they can take back and train and exercise off of.
Keith, who do you work for?
I actually work for a commission that is made up of the mayors of all of the different communities within Story County, one representative of the Board of Supervisors, and the sheriff, which is a really great setup in most respects because this involves all of the communities, and it's one vote for each of the communities on the commission. So it brings them together, gives us a chance to bring in all of the jurisdictional executives, the mayors, and for us to work on emergency management because it really has to be a whole community. No one community alone can afford all the resources, and it's just not cost-effective. So if we can get everybody there as a part of a commission that it has the true responsibility that they delegate down to me, that's a key aspect to it.
And who does fund this?
The funding actually comes in this county, and it can be different across all the different counties. We come from the special general levy, which is collected by the county. It's a separate funding source for us. And again, the county's got to collect it, but then we operate off of it. And it's the main thing for us is my position and my deputy's position so that we can have somebody available 24/7 all the time. And also for us to do a lot of that stuff that each of the individual jurisdictions or disciplines couldn't do on their own. When it's things that come together, then we're spending an awful lot of time doing plans and exercises mm-hmm. and those kind of activities.
So you're on call 24/7.
24/7. During a typical response, what will happen if it would be large scale is both of us would be alerted. And if we can work from our homes, we're completely mobile. We work from our homes. We can work from the field. If the situation grows, one of us might work from our home to be gathering information while the other person goes out into the field. And then when we get established out in the field, that person from home, if it's 2 a.m., would go on into our emergency operations center, start getting that going. And then we would just grow that support network to the people that are out there actually dealing with the event.
Very dynamic.
It goes across the full spectrum. And what we do nowadays, as opposed to having a tornado plan and a flooding plan and a wildfire plan, we have what we call all hazards. And it's different functions that we've got to do. We've got to move things. So we have a transportation section. Fire is usually a big part of it. So we have a section, a function for that, for public safety. And instead of having all these different plans, we just pull those different functions off of the bookshelf and integrate them together to respond to any kind of a hazard. Nowadays, you look at it, it can be anything from the terrorist event to an anhydrous ammonia leak to a tornado to flooding to cyber attack. We have to be prepared for all of those kind of events.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this past month, there really has not been any sort of safety emergency. Is that correct?
Either myself or the deputy, we've had a couple of storms that go through. Those storms that impacted Adair County and Dallas County, We're up during the night watching those to make sure and try and push them to somebody else's county as much as we can.
Push the storms?
Yeah.
We're hoping
and wishing that it goes someplace else besides our county.
So you have like some sort of hotline to God?
Well, we do anything that we can, and we don't really because we know the emergency managers in those counties, and we may feel sorry for them, but we're always happy when it doesn't strike our county.
Yeah,
but we're monitoring them again, looking at what are the potential impacts. We work with a lot of the local fire departments around here. There are storm spotters. There are eyes and ears on the ground during severe weather. So that we can see what's happening and try and predict what kind of resources are going to be needed. And if need be, we can recommend activation of the outdoor warning sirens as a part of that.
So despite the storms, it's been a relatively safe month in June.
June was a good month for us, yes.
Yeah, although our tower got hit once and temporarily put us out. But.
It's interesting. You have a good month when nothing happens and nobody does anything.
when the weather doesn't do anything.
And that is one of the issues when it comes to emergency management. We're insurance. Nobody likes to buy insurance for them.
That's right.
And to get agencies to invest the time and effort on the planning and everything else for something that might happen. The tornado. Yeah, it struck Joplin, but we haven't had a tornado here in Story County in a long time. And now Parkersburg was 2008, and that is a difficult part of emergency management. And what's the right amount of insurance to buy? That's
right.
always, you know, how much do we invest in equipment that we might have to use someday?
Right, yeah.
So we're always battling that.
Yeah, the Alaska Pipeline had to deal with that issue when they didn't invest enough in safety management.
Exactly right. We call it risk management in there, but that's why our commission setup is very good. It's made of the people that are setting taxes and things like that. They are the ones that are having to manage the risk across the county through the commission as to how much is enough.
But then there's always that moment when there is an emergency and the protocol and the equipment and the staff is there. And in that moment, really good that somebody foresaw this.
It's really worthwhile. We're fortunate. Our emergency operations center is staffed by Story County administrative people. Story County, as an entity, doesn't have to do that, but they have stepped up and provided a staff. And we do four times a year, we do about an hour and a half training with all of the staff so that they'll know what their functions are at 2 a.m. in the morning. When they come on in, and no matter what it might be, a train derailment or whatever, they've got that basic amount of training to be able to help us integrate resources from the state and other folks.
Well, thank you, Keith.
Yeah. Any last words about July?
No, we're hoping that it's as slow as June was when it comes to the weather.
Sounds good.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been one of your hosts. I'm Jim Werbel, together with Ursula Rudenberg. Today, we spoke with local business people Gary Youngberg of Ames Silversmithing, Judy Gilger of Gilger Designs, as well as Commander Huff of the Ames Police, addressing different perspectives on Ames and an Ames ordinance dealing with merchants that buy and sell secondhand goods.
And then we also spoke with Aliyah Gerganis and Al Biela from the Iowa School of Rock. Their annual summer performance is going to be on July 10th and 11th at 7:30 at Bluestem, or what's formerly known as Zeke's. And finally, we were lucky to have Keith Morgan here this morning again, Story County Emergency Supervisors, for a monthly safety check-in and kind of more information about what exactly emergency services are. And we look forward to having you again on the first Monday of next month. And maybe hopefully there won't be a whole lot to talk about. I was thinking maybe one thing we could talk about next month is the preparedness plan, like the specifics of what people can do to have in their preparedness emergency kits.
That'd be great.
Local Talk was engineered by Richard Morrison. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. You will also find our lists of our guests and contact information to the organizations as we speak, with the other resources mentioned on our shows. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join the team as reporters, I did, contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
And we are glad you joined us. And we also have another engineer here, Jonah DeGeest. And thank you, Jonah. And your participation as the audience is what makes KHOI possible. If you weren't listening to us, we wouldn't be doing anything meaningful. So thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.